You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Do you think I could rock a Viking linen shirt in the field this season? Welcome to episode 15 of A Life in Ruins podcast. I'm your host, Carlton Gover, and as always, I'm joined by my co-hosts, Connor, the face tattoo Johnin, and David Howe. Our guest tonight is Dr. Brian Schroeder, who is currently the director of the Center for Big Ben Studies at Sul Ross University in Alpine, Texas, the scholastic powerhouse of West Texas. He received his undergraduate and master's degree from the University of Wyoming and received his PhD from the University of Montana. Connor is extra excited for Brian to be on the show, as Brian was one of the graduate assistants for his field school and helped him fall in love with archaeology. How cute. Brian has extensive experience in Wyoming archaeology, high altitude archaeology, and now extensive work in cave excavations in West Texas. He is now working on some super interesting research stemming from his excavations in Texas. We are so excited to have him on the podcast and to have him embarrass Connor. Thank you for joining us today, Dr. Schroeder. How are you doing?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
No problem.
Of course.
If you don't mind, we'll start off by just introducing, I mean, we have that intro part, but introducing who you are and what you do as the director of the Center for Big Ben Studies.
Well, I guess my name is Brian Schroeder, as you said. I'm the current director for the Center for Big Ben Studies. I have only been the director for about a little over 2 weeks now, so it's a new role for me. But in that role, I craft the research that we do here. I'm sort of the de facto head of the department, but I'm the only one who teaches, so I just have to keep myself in check, and which isn't always easy to do. And I'm the lead fundraiser, and we're pretty unique in that we have access to huge private ranches, and we're allowed to research whatever we want on those ranches. So we have literally 13,000 years of prehistory that we can kind of do whatever we want with. So I'm trying to keep that in check because I also have to fundraise. So there's a financial side and a research side, and trying to make those two meet is really my day to day.
All right. So it's, you figured that all out in 2 weeks, I'm assuming.
We got it. We're on the road to success right now. I have a small staff, and I have to keep them happy, and they have their own pet interests. And I'm not from Texas, and there's a lot of, let's say,
xenophobia.
Yes. I'm sort of an outsider to Texas archaeology, and so for the most part, everybody's very accommodating, but I still feel like I'm approached with like a little bit of suspicion, like, well, you're not Texan.
my partner is from Texas, and she's always talking about Texas, 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 and I'm like, what is so special about a failed state than part of a failed rebellion?
Well, even in Texas, there's a incredible, and this is like in no way like meant to be condescending or anything, but there's a special and fierce love for West Texas in particular, but there's an even more diehard love for far West Texas. And this is a place where very few people are from, but then they move here and it becomes theirs, and they're like fiercely fiercely like protective of this place, which is kind of interesting, and it can make things rewarding.
Interesting. Like, yeah. Far West Texas being like New Mexico, basically.
Well, they would never claim that. Like, we were just talking with, I was just talking with some folks recently that aren't from here, and West Texas seems to stop at Odessa in Midland. And then we're 2 hours south of that. And we're our own thing that's really the most famous for the art community in Marfa. And it's got huge installations from Donald Judd, and that he made it really, really famous. So there's a huge art community, but other than that, I mean, that's why people are here. So, yeah.
I just pictured Josh Brolin sitting on his porch, spitting into something.
That's actually filmed on the ranch that I do most of my research.
Oh, really?
Oh. That's not an inappropriate stereotype to have.
Speaking of ranches, you're a Wyoming boy?
Yeah.
You want to tell us a little about that?
Yeah, I was raised in Wyoming in Casper.
Oh.
Yeah. And I really never had any intention of leaving. Definitely didn't see myself moving to Texas. But I guess just like that, Texans are fiercely protective of far west Texas. I'm the same way with Wyoming, but unlike, I guess, the love for Texas, I don't really know what I'm defending in Wyoming. I guess I love the scenery and the archaeology. And it was a great place to be raised, a great place to get interested in archaeology, but I don't think I'd want to live there full time.
Yeah, I remember you telling me about some of your childhood, because you said that you and your father would go hunting, right? And you wouldn't be super good at the hunting part because you were looking for artifacts.
I was a lousy hunter. My dad got so upset at me every single time we went, because there's one time he pointed out a bunch of deer and said, "Do you see him?" And I was like, I don't, but I see that arrowhead right there pointing at it. And he was, "We're hunting." Yeah, there's an arrowhead right there. So that's really cool. that's all I did. That's like, as a kid, I will absolutely admit it, I was a hardcore surface collector in Wyoming. I don't have a big collection by any means, but that was definitely my pastime, and made me really bad at hiking and hunting and all the things that your dad wants to do.
Your face is just constantly at the ground.
Yeah. You're constantly behind all your friends when you're backpacking, and like, "No, I'm coming. There's just a sight back there.
Oh, I'm just out of breath. That's why I'm way in the back. But yeah, I was doing that. So you went to, I guess, your undergrad and master's at UW, right?
Yeah, I did both of those at the University of Wyoming.
Awesome.
Yeah, I did. I came from, no one in my family had gone to college. So it started at the community college in Casper, and knew I wanted to do archaeology, and then kind of did 2 years at Casper College. And then I thought I would just keep doing the cultural resource management stuff. And then I never really had any end goal. Like, I never had, definitely didn't have a PhD in mind, didn't really have grad school in mind. It just kind of kept evolving as I kind of kept going through cultural resource management.
Now, since you spent quite some time in Wyoming, do you have a Bob Kelly impression?
My Bob Kelly impression would be abject silence. I just remember sitting there and staring at the hamster picture in his office and why he sat there and looked out the window. And I thought I had just insulted the man. Every time I had a question, I just thought, I just said the dumbest thing in the world. And he would just sit there and he would just stare out the window and kind of play with his beard, and then stare at that hamster.
And then he would look at me
and go, "Yes, I think you should do that."
So for our listeners, Robert L. Kelly is a famous archaeologist. It's really thoughtful when he speaks and like really thinks about his answer. And there's kind of this running joke of his students of, you get to know all the books on his bookshelf while you wait for him to respond. For that reason, is you just ask him something and he just sits there like Dr. Schroeder was saying, just, he just strokes his beard and looks out the window or looks up, and you just kind of sit there for like a minute or two, like, what the hell did I get myself into? And you're just kind of staring off, looking at the books on his shelf or the hamster picture.
He's like from Lord of the Rings. So he just like takes forever to say something.
It's amazing. I got really familiar with the picture of his kids on his desk because I would always like kind of like look over there. But yeah. God, I love Bob. I miss him.
Like, not coming from that background, I always just thought, I just insulted him. I just wasted. I I'm sorry. I'll take it back. I can leave. I can get out of here.
I was sitting in his office one time trying to ask him about like my thesis. It was like my first year there.
Yeah.
And I didn't know like that's what he did. So he just like said, I asked him something like, do you think that's a good idea? And then he like went, turned around, looked out the window, and there was like 30 seconds to a minute of just awkward silence. And then he turns back around and looks at me and he's like, what were we talking about? And I was like, oh my God, this is brutal. He hates me.
He did that to me once too and said, look at this car down here. This car is stuck. And I was like, oh, okay. I can just leave. I'll just leave.
there was, man. I was this TA my first semester at Wyoming for my master's. And I was at the classroom building and he went to the anthro department, but you know, there's that cafe there and I went and got a sandwich and I was walking back. They had water main had busted and Bob was just standing there like staring at it with this big grin on his face. I was like, what's up, Dr. Kelly? He goes, I don't think they meant to do that. And he's just smiling. And I was like, okay. It just kind of kept walking and he was just fascinated. It was amazing.
Ooh, Bob Kelly, the anarchist, apparently.
Secretly.
Speaking of University of Wyoming, you also did you also did some field work with Dr. Todd Saravelle at the University of Wyoming. Is that correct?
Yes.
His like famous site, Dr. Saravelle, that he published on, did his dissertation on, I think, or at least part of it, is Barger Gulch, and you actually worked there. You had a good time there, I hear.
Yeah, I spent, I believe, 30 days there and helped these Dr. Matty O'Brien now. I think he's in California.
Yeah, he's at Chico.
Yeah, Chico. And helped them set up the site. And it was the first 5 days where I'd never dug with a university. So it was my first time out. And Todd asked me, because I had done a lot of consulting work up to that point, and Todd asked me, have you ever dug with a trowel? Yeah, I have one. I own one. It was a very interesting site. Yeah, there was a lot of the first cohort for PhD students at Wyoming were there. Patrick Mullen was there. That was interesting. And he ended up dying in a car crash in Alaska. And It was just a really chaotic field session, but everybody there is teaching somewhere now. I mean, it was, I don't know, but there's a lot of stories there, but I don't really want to get into it and incriminate it.
Yeah. I heard the after hours entertainment was, especially good.
Especially good. Yes. That's a fantastic way of putting it. It was always entertaining. Todd had some very bizarre games. He really likes golfing in the prairie. There was a lot of golf. And then there was horseshoes, but then it blended into – I can't even remember what they called it. But it was just – you take the horseshoes and he'd have these like courses, golf-like courses lined out, and he would throw the horseshoes like you were golfing, and he would just keep throwing the horseshoes until you got to the hole, and people obviously threw out their shoulders all the time.
It sounds like a rancher version of Frisbee golf.
I don't even remember what he called it. it was chaos. And we didn't find any archaeology. We found nothing, which was great for Todd because he had planted. He thought that they were central. He thought that they were Folsom structures. So he picked areas that should have been outside of the structures, and they were, which was fantastic for him. But yeah, we didn't find
a little
anything.
Heart-wrenching and questioning of your sanity.
Everybody was promised Folsom points. Yeah, we got to hear about the years of amazing Folsom stuff they had found, and I think we found like 15 flakes that summer. So
morale was low. As quick as possible, can you explain like what Barger Gulch was, like why it's a famous site?
It's a single occupation Folsom site, and it's really shallowly buried. So it's all Folsom, and it's parked on top of a chert formation, a troublesome chert formation. So you get a really good expression of Folsom stuff there, and there seems to be Folsom structures there, just like the Mountaineer site. So you have Folsom activity areas associated with probably structures, and the hearth had eroded away. So they were using that based off of burn lithics. So some really cool stuff happening there, and kind of an innovative way to figure it out. So
cool. Yeah, that's not right.
And for our listeners, Folsom is an archaeological culture. It's the second or third oldest, depending on which, you know, department you're in the country. And it was actually the first, and it's based on projectile points, spear points. There's a beautiful flute in the middle of them. And it was actually what confirmed that people were here with megafauna, because they were found and associated with some extinct bison antiquus, which are very large bison. And it kind of revolutionized how we thought of peopling in the Americas for its time. And since then, we've found Clovis, which is also a different projectile point. And then there are these Western stem points that are the cause of some fiery debates at SAAs now. But with that, it looks like we have a couple angry ranchers who are looking for shoes for their horses. We're going to get this wrapped up, and we'll be back with segment two here in a moment.
That could have been better.
I'm trying to tie it back, dude. God damn it.
Chris Webster here to tell you about one of our affiliates, Timular. That's Timeular. Whether you work from home or can go to the office or even to the field, Timular is an app, and if you want it, a physical device that helps you track your time down to the minute. Have a hard time separating your work-life balance? Set a weekly goal for tracked work hours and stop when you hit that goal. It's right in the app. So support the APN and finally start accurately tracking your time by heading to arcpodnet.com/timular. That's arcpodnet.com/timular to get on track today. Hey, fans of archaeology, head over to arcpodnet.com/shop and click the link to our Tee Public store. You'll find some awesome designs that you can pick up on t-shirts, mugs, and more. From our Ask an Archaeologist series to the worst idea the Life in Ruins podcast ever had, slamming agriculture. I mean, seriously. Again, that's arcpodnet.com/shop for some archaeo swag.
Welcome back to segment two of episode 15 of a Life in Ruins podcast. For the audience that might not be aware, Wyoming, and the reason why a lot of us go there for graduate school, is it's like a giant just Jurassic Park of archaeology and prehistory. Like the whole state is just littered with archaeology and just geographic features. So it's just an awesome place to do archaeology. Connor has a question for Brian, because they used to work together in the field, right?
Yeah, unfortunately. for him, of course. So yeah. When you had mentioned earlier that you would go hunting and kind of with your father, and you weren't very good at it because you liked looking for artifacts. And you were nearby kind of the site that you did your master's research when you were doing that, right?
Yeah, I was looking for a site related to what I was doing my master's research on. Yeah.
Oh, cool. Cool. So could you explain what the Shirley Basin site is in 10 words or less? I'm just kidding.
really cool. Is that
that's accurate. Enough?
Okay. It's the Shirley Basin site. It's a huge, huge prehistoric camp. I don't even know what the final limits of it ended up being, but what's really neat about it in particular is that on a small part of this giant site that takes up acres, I mean, it's a monster site littered with tons of occupational debris, are these coursed structures that they're circular, some are square, but they're really stacked, and they're really unique in the Wyoming landscape. There's a lot of single core stone circles that a lot of people think are teepee rings. And I would say that, you know, some are, some aren't, but this in particular, these are really funky coursed things. And the site, we were really near it when I was hunting with my dad as a kid, and I honestly didn't know that. And when I was doing my master's research, I did it on defensive sites in Wyoming, really late period, contact period, indigenous fortifications. And this site, the Shirley Basin Lodge site, had been always talked about as being, because of these walls, a part of that fortification sites in Wyoming. And I was trying to find it, and the location data for it was wrong. So I kind of gave up and said, you know what? I haven't been back to that site that we went to, that we found when, you know, we were hunting, when I was hunting with my dad, and I went back there and accidentally stumbled across the Shirley Basin site and had the pictures with me. And I was like, no way. This is exactly what I was looking for. So it was really serendipitous. And it ended up a very, I think I ended up working there for a long time, at least over 5 years.
Yeah. A lot of field sessions, one of my field school sessions was there. And you weren't joking. It was like crazy to walk through. And when you're describing the courses are, for folks who might not know, are they're just different stacks of rocks. So one course being just a single stack of rocks. Multiple courses are these kind of, they almost look like larger white man's fires. Is that accurate?
I would say they almost look like Puebloan structures, except without masonry. They're these stacked houses, stone houses. And that's what it ended up. That site was actually recorded by Dr. Frizen in 1967. And that's what they called them, stone houses. They look like rectangular stone houses, circular.
So the Shirley Basin site was excavated over a July 4th weekend by Dr. Frizen. Is that correct?
Yeah. It was a long weekend, 3 days. And it was the first collaborative effort from the Amateur Archaeological Society, the Wyoming Archaeological Society, and the Office of the Wyoming State Archaeologist. So it was one of the first things where they came together, and it was brought to the attention of Dr. Frizen by a collector named Lou Stege. And they went out there over July 4th weekend and excavated. They found 21 of those coursed structures, and they dug 17 of them and said that they were going to keep 3 for future researchers. And when we went out there, part of our work was focused on exactly what happened, because there are no notes for the site, and it was a little bit hard to figure out what they did, because they stored the artifacts in the basement of the Arts and Science Building, and there was a pipe burst, and all of the boxes melted together. So
there's like zero context.
There was like zero. Everything just melted together, and it was like somebody went back and said,
"Makes my blood boil."
Yeah, this is what came from that one, and this is what came from that one, and there was like concrete nails and stuff. It's like they shoveled stuff into boxes, and so we were trying to part of why we were there when we went is to figure out if we could find anything left.
Anything that was in,
and intact. I think we were successful.
Oh yeah,
yeah,
we found some things.
Yeah.
You were also working with Dr. Richard Adams at High Rise Village in the Wind River Range. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yep.
That's it. And I did a part of another segment of our field school was spent up there. This site is like, is it 11,000 feet or 10,000 feet?
It's 10,200 to 11,000 feet. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's this kind of similar arrangement as the Shirley Basin site. You have these kind of, they're less obvious, less coursed than the Shirley Basin site. But you have this kind of large housing apartment complex almost at 11 or 10 to 11,000 feet.
Yeah. That is correct.
Yeah, that is the end of my thought. And that kind of those kind of similarities and your interest in high altitude archaeology kind of led into your dissertation, right?
Yeah, the sites are really similar, and there's this pervasive idea, especially in Wyoming archaeology, about this stuff being part of the Shoshonean migration out of California, and that always intrigued me. And I mean, I was always taught it, and I always thought, I mean, that's really neat that you could associate these artifacts with a specific ethnic group. And that's sort of what sparked everything. And I mean, there are obvious similarities in all of the tools and the structures at the two sites. I mean, there's real overlap. There's a lot of brownware pottery, and the arrowheads they're making are the same, and a lot of the same stone tools show up. So I started thinking, and my dissertation was very simple. Is this part of a seasonal migration where they use the lowlands like Shirley Basin for a portion of the year, and high-rise village represents the high-altitude portion of this, and Shirley Basin represents the, like, sort of the lower elevation adaptation by this similar group, was kind of how I saw the overlap, which is a nice idea, but incredibly hard to prove, is what I found out.
It's only separated by, and you said these sites are like how many miles apart from each other?
They're like 138 miles apart.
So it's within theoretical kind of walking distance. And yeah,
I think that there's a horse component to it too. I think those groups probably using the, I think even at High Rise Village, that horse, if it wasn't involved, it was like the last throes of not using it for increased mobility. Because there's the problem with High Rise Village is that all the radiocarbon dates are really hard to get. There's just no way to really radiocarbon date that site because that alpine environment preserves stuff too well. All of the wood they were burning is too old. So you get really old dates, and there's just no way to really figure out the temporal overlap of them. So, yeah.
I think this is topical and it might be a little late for it, but what didn't you post a map earlier, Carlton, about the horse kind of introduction?
Yes, I did, Connor. I did that today. This semester I'm a research assistant for Dr. Will Taylor, and his thing is horses. He worked with Todd in Mongolia, Todd Servo, actually. Now he's at Boulder, and he was like, read this book, and gave me this big old book on in Native American bridles and saddles and stuff. And then one of those maps was a distribution of horses, which is not, I don't know a thing about horses that's out of my wheelhouse. So like, I'm just kind of learning all this stuff. But the map, I am told, is not like the mainstream or whatever, but it's appears to actually be supported by current radiocarbon dates coming out of horse bones. But anyways, it shows horse distribution based on indigenous oral histories as well as European accounts, and like it's multiple data used to, and so basically why people are skeptical of this map is it shows horses earlier than previously thought. Now, of course, not earlier than 1492, that'd be freaking ridiculous, right? But it just kind of shows like, yeah, you know, it wasn't really the pub. Yeah, yes. Yeah, so it basically just shows a lot of these tribes got horses earlier than we thought, and it wasn't just really the Pueblo revolts that really released them, but, you know, people lose stuff, and it's, you know, when you have hundreds of horses, a couple kind of wander away, and, you know, during those trade networks back then, like, the new, you know, all-terrain animal that shows up, it's going to get spread pretty quickly, and the relationships between tribes, like, if you think Comanche and Shoshone, they're related, right? Pawnee, Arikara, they're related, they're trading with their neighbors and their allies and their family, so, like, horses actually spread rather quickly.
Yeah.
So, yes, Connor, to answer your story, I shared a map today.
Well, it says, I was reading that, and it looked like it estimated, like, 1640 for the eastern Shoshone is what they have current, or Eastern Shoshone and Comanche.
Yeah.
So, which is, an interesting. So, this, I'm trying to think of, when are the radiocarbon dates? Do they fall in that kind of area, Brian? Or are they a little?
Yeah, Shirley Basin is that old, but the High Rise Village, the only date that's been rejected by everybody else who went up there was the date that dates to that period, which I think is the only date that's right. But I lost that debate. So that's a whole other story. yeah, but I mean, that's what I thought, that there were a way to do it. And they just see really weird. You see different. I mean, you just see there's huge amount of tiger chert up at high rise, and you start to see soapstone get moved around. And I think, as you know, soapstone bowls are incredibly heavy, so you're not lugging those around. You're using something to move those around. And my thinking was that there were soapstone bowls down at Shirley Basin, and there was a lot of the chert from the mountains at Shirley Basin initially in the 60s, and we would find that stuff, but we did not find that stuff.
We found a whole nother conundrum, as it was. It's an interesting.
Speaking of finding that stuff, did you go up into the mountains with Connor on his llama adventure? Was that you?
I did not Llamas, go with David. Connor's llama adventure, but it wasn't because I didn't want to.
That's what he says.
Okay, I thought maybe that was you.
We did spend time in the mountains together at high rise, obviously, being horse supported, which is like a whole nother kind of field work.
Yes. We did. We went to the Tetons too.
Oh, yeah.
Romantic. Yeah. Some Brokeback Mountain level archaeology going on.
We skipped the chairlift to the top.
Just two archaeologists in the mountains.
They didn't find artifacts, but they found love.
All right. Well, that's fun. Okay. Let's wrap this up and pump the brakes while we can, and I'll take it in session three.
Yeah, where do we go from here?
The Archaeology Podcast Network is now available on the educational podcast app Lyceum, spelled L-Y-C-E-U-M. You can find it on your phone's app store. The APN joins other educational shows like Radiolab, Science Versus, and 99% Invisible. Do you want to learn something? Then the Lyceum app is for you. It's free to download and free to listen. Oh, and you can chat with the hosts right in the app. That's right. Podcast listening isn't a one-way street anymore, folks. So check out Lyceum on your phone's app store or over at www.lyceum.fm. That's L-Y-C-E-U-M.fm. Learn something today. Chris Webster here. Did you know that I edit most of the podcasts on the Archaeology Podcast Network? I've been doing this since about 2012 when we started the CRM Archaeology Podcast. In 2017, I solidified my audio education by completing a certification course at the Podcast Engineering School. Now I train people in podcasting and produce and edit podcasts for others. Head over to Chris Webster Productions at propodcastnow.com. If you've always wanted to have a podcast for yourself or your business, now's the time. I'll show you how to do it or do some or all of it for you. You can also take my self-guided online course. Whatever your podcast production needs are, I can help out at propodcastnow.com.
Welcome back. This is episode 15 of a Life in Ruins podcast. We're interviewing Dr. Brian Schroeder, and I want to start this section kind of talking about your current research while the giggling minstrels in the back keep giggling. So you had texted me at some point telling me about something you had found in someone's house, if you want to elaborate.
Yeah, I can give you a little backstory to that too and bring you up there. I got hired here to research on one of the ranches, a large private ranch. It's 70,000 acres. And the landowner has a large cave system, and no professional archaeologist had ever been to that cave system. But it's very obvious that had been looted for no one knew how long. So my research goals were to sort of, one, figure out the history, see if there was anything left to do at the site, because it looks like a moonscape. You can tell people have been digging it for decades. And it was one of the few sites in Texas that has a trinomial. Especially in West Texas, it costs money, so not a lot of professionals get registered the sites with the state of Texas. So this one had one, and that sort of led me down a rabbit hole where I ended up finding out that among very many stories that I could tell you, but one that you're alluding to is there were four burials that were taken out of the cave, one in 1960 and then two in well, two in 1952, one in 1960, and then one in 1968. And the one in 1968 ended up in a private collection. And that's, I ended up calling everybody in the phone book with that particular person's last name to see if I could find that individual. And I found them, and I ended up finding out that they had donated the human remains, and they thought, but one of the other collectors had kept them, and the human remains are still in this private collection. And I still don't really know how to talk about it other than I relocated those human remains, and they're in a fake papier-mâché cave behind a fake wall in a basically private house. And that's not where I thought this research in the ground would lead me. I thought we'd be doing our own research, and I certainly didn't think that we'd be tracking human burials into somebody's house. So, but I think that made it much more worthwhile. So part of that research was just figuring, like, authenticating it, making sure it was associated with the site, and then starting a dialogue with what the person's, like, what is your end goal with these remains? Yeah,
what are your intentions?
Exactly. Like, what are we doing here? And that's very much ongoing, and as you can imagine, pretty delicate.
Yeah, to put it lightly.
Yeah.
So they eventually, you did get permission from this person to research the body or the remains, right?
I got permission to initially come and look at them. They denied even owning them for about a year and a half. And I would call once a month and just say, hey, look, I have paperwork that says that you have them. Do you have them? And I got no every single time. And then I did my monthly call one time, and they just said, you're not going to give up, are you? And I was like, I'm not. Do you have them? And they said, yeah, I have them. And I was like, great. Can I come just see if it's what I think came out of the cave? Because I had a picture of them in front of the cave, the remains. And I went up there, and she didn't seem that interested in me seeing them for about an hour and a half. And I thought that, well, maybe this isn't going to happen. And then it sort of switched, and she had mentioned that they were upstairs, and they weren't, they were downstairs. And it's kind of a really weird, beyond owning the remains, she herself feels a real, because they've owned them for over 50 years, she feels a real connection with these remains too. So they're Native American remains, and I was given access to them, but they're also part of this like family collection, and they feel like they've taken care of them really well for half a century. So you have to also talk to that side of them, the equation, which was, they don't really teach you that in grad school.
No, I don't think there's a class on that.
I didn't want to be judgmental, because the landowner who owned the cave, it was made it a paid to dig cave. For most of this history, he would charge a fee, and you could come collect anything you wanted out of the cave. And that's 100% legal in Texas because of the private laws here. And we can sort of pass judgment on that, and I think we should, but you can't alienate them. If somebody had come to you in 1952, we're all archaeologists, and said, hey, there's this cave on my land, and you can dig it, and whatever you find is yours. I don't know if in 1952 I would have said no. Now, finding human remains, I definitely wouldn't have kept them and made a fake cave and put them in my house. I feel confident in saying that, but I don't know that I would have said no to that equation otherwise. So it's a really sticky situation, and I sort of know what I want the end goal to be, and I would like to get them out of the collection, and I'd like to get them back into the cave, and I'd like to do that in consultation with Native groups. But at the same time, you sort of have to acknowledge that there's these private property rights here, which it's not a great situation. And maybe the compromise, whatever happens, I don't think it's going to be a best case for any of us. So.
Yeah. For the audience listening, we talked about NAGPRA a couple podcasts ago. And maybe it's different in Texas, but in the rest of the country, it's highly frowned upon and more or less illegal to keep human remains in your private collection. It depends on it. State law varies, but either way, it's not really ethical. It's also just
weird.
I mean, yeah, just weird. Like those belong. They're not you. You have a human body, like someone in your house. That's like, it's just weird. Don't do that.
This is a dry cave too. So they're fully fleshed. I mean, they're desiccated.
Oh, yeah.
They're
worse.
They're mummies. There's God. Four of them. Yeah. They have fingernails. They have hair. They're fully fleshed, which to me makes it even weirder. And the collectors that didn't want to keep it, they wanted to donate it to a museum in San Antonio. The fact that they were so well preserved was the line in the sand for them. They were, it really affected them, but not the person who owns it. And she's very candid about talking about that.
The museum was like, no, we don't want to.
Well, no, that what actually happened was the person lied. They gave it to a student. Well, there's actually two sets of remains. And the one that we're talking about that's in a private collection, that one, the brothers just took it back with them and they kept it and passed it through the family. It's been through several generations of brothers. And yeah, that one's another thing. But there was another one, the one that was supposed to go to the Witte in San Antonio, that one, the guy who said he would take it there and said he had the connection kept it. And then he trafficked it on the black market. He sold it out of the back of a shotgun magazine to a buyer in Palm Springs, California. And that person in Palm Springs, California got busted 10 years after buying it for raising and taxidermying exotic species. And the Game and Fish let a bust on his house. And when they busted into his house, they saw a mummy in what the coroner described as a terrarium. And they immediately called the cops and said, this is creepy. This is a murder scene.
That's some Florida shit.
Yeah. Yeah. And the coroner figured out that it was a prehistoric set of human remains, and it got brought back to Texas. And that one's actually in the University of Texas at Austin. But the other one's still in a private collection, and they're both very delicate. And what's interesting, so my research that I'm doing now to tie this all together, I got access to them, and those individuals are related after doing DNA on them. So they're related, and there's because of radiocarbon dating, there's as much as 220 years between them and as little as 50 years, which means that a generation of matrilineally related hunter-gatherers were using this cave for at least 200 years. And so, I mean, from the research end, that's where we got. And now I'm still figuring out where to take that.
That's super insane. That's the craziest story I've heard in archaeology in a long time.
Yeah, that's pretty wild.
Yeah, it's not what I started the cave because I thought we would find some baskets. That's really what I was looking for. I really wanted to find some good perishable material, and I wanted to. That's where I wanted to go. And I certainly didn't think that I'd be talking to coroners in Riverside County, California. And yeah, a crazy thing. But I mean, at the same time, it was incredibly rewarding because no one would ever know. No one would ever tie those back. And at this. No one would ever know that those human remains are from that cave. And now we can start this dialogue, and it's awkward and it's cumbersome, but now we can do it. And I hope that ends somewhere that's kind of a good middle ground for all of us.
Yeah. And it's part of our profession, and can be an unfortunate or good part of our profession that we're the middleman in this. Kind of.
Yes.
No. we're kind of the people who have to talk to private collection people who collect privately are looters and the actual native communities themselves. We have to be that bridge because that's where we're placed ourselves.
And here in particular, there's so much private land that you wouldn't know if, there isn't that liaison without a professional archaeologist. So we have to gain the trust of the landowner to get on the land, which is difficult to do. And then once we do that, so this case in particular, then I had to gain the trust of a collector that talked to a different landowner than owns the land now. And that landowner is very pro science, but the previous one wasn't. So they took it with a clear title from the landowner that they bought access to the cave with. And so you have to have that conversation. But then at the end of the day, we all know that those are native remains and there needs to be a native at the table. And that's a very delicate situation to gain the trust of the landowner too with everything. It's complex, but it's incredibly rewarding.
Yeah. Yeah. Like a descendant community situation.
Yeah. And yeah. And
the end goal is to go back into the cave in a ceremony that's befitting of what would be done for their normal burial procedures or ceremonies.
Yeah. I would like to get them back in the cave. And from a research standpoint, I feel like we've answered what we can answer at the cave right now. And I feel I have no problem walking away. I have no problem returning that to what it was. It was occupied for at least 6,000 years. And at the end of it, it very clearly became a burial cave. And I have no problem returning it to that. And walking away, I don't think the landowner has a problem with that. I mean, there's plenty of other stuff to do here. And there's plenty of other collections to look at. And I think that's where it kind of needs to go.
That's, to be the final, hopefully the end to that story. But like you said, you don't know how that's going to end because of these balancing communities. Yeah.
There's a lot of stakeholders.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, they're only stakeholders because the law is in Texas is fucked. At the end of the day, it's like other states like Colorado, Wyoming passed a law that's like you find graves, period, you leave them alone,
right?
And it's unfortunate that you have to cater to the property owner, and I mean, like, morally and ethically the whole situation, as we've stated, is just Titanic level bullshittery.
It's yes, that is definitely a good way of saying it. It's incredibly complex, and here the way to do it would be to change the legislation, but here you're not going to do it because 95% of the state is private. So I don't agree with how the law crafts it, but my hope is to start the dialogue and maybe appeal to people's morality and that supersedes the law, and that's how we get things done, because at the end of the day, they're not going to get in trouble. There's no trigger for anything.
Yeah, as you've been talking, I've been like frantically searching Texas law regarding what the fuck is going on. And like, yeah, even it's not just natives. It's like anyone who's not on state or federal land. It's so the quickest way to change it is to start digging up white people.
Well, no, that's actually what the law is for. The law protects Civil War graves. That's what the law is written for. It'd be easy to do an unmarked prehistoric burial law. It'd be easy to exclude historic Native American graves and prehistoric burials from it and keep Civil War cemeteries open. So what happens is the law triggers a Civil War, like, it doesn't say Civil War, but that's what it was for, to make sure that if your Civil War ancestors were buried on somebody else's private land, you could still have access to them. So that's why it opens up the law. But because of that, all this other stuff gets ensnared in it. It's like three or four words that need to be changed. And I think that could be done. I'll say that. I think it could be done.
Welcome to Texas, where you get 40 acres and a mule and some Indian bones. Change that one.
Yeah.
God. Damn the Confederacy.
Thanks for coming on, Brian. And hopefully we have a conversation with you in the future where this is all solved in an appropriate manner. And maybe even Texas law has changed. But, you know.
Let's just burn the fucking state down. Like, who needs Texas? Like, God damn them. They can't be their own country. They can't be part of a rebellion. Like, who needs it? Give it back to Mexico.
I don't know if they treat bodies any better there, man. On that,
what would be our problem?
Silent on all
Built the wall, Texas.
Oh man. Okay, but on that note, thank you, Brian, for coming on.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. So we just interviewed Dr. Brian Schroeder, who's the current director of the Center for Big Bend Studies at Sol Ross University in Alpine, Texas. This is the end of episode 15. We'll see you next time.
Well, you won't see us. You'll listen to us. If you can't see us, it's a podcast.
Yeah. Get it right.
No comment.
Thanks for listening to a Life in Ruins podcast.
You can follow us on Instagram and Facebook at a Life in Ruins podcast. And you can also email us at alifeinruinspodcast@gmail.com.
And remember, make sure to bring your archaeologists in from the cold and feed them beer.
So what's the difference between archaeology and grave robbing? Archaeology is when you dig up Indians, grave robbing is when you dig up white people.
Brutal.
I'm in a mood now.
All right.
Sorry.
Episode 15. See you guys soon.
This show is produced by the Archaeology Podcast Network, Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in Reno, Nevada at the Reno Collective.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.